Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. We have one of the most mysterious, magical guests on that we've had in a long time. We did a show with her earlier many years ago. Her name is Betty Sue Flowers. She is not only an incredible rainmaker and a change agent, an editor, an author, a facilitator, but she's one of the kindest, most powerful human beings I've ever met, with elegance and grace like very few people have had a chance to interface with. Betty Sue is the former director of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library and Museum and a former emeritus professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin. She is the author of many books and an editor of many books, some of which are Bill Moyers, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth, A World of Ideas, Healing in the Mind, and Genesis in the Modern Traditions. She's published 3 books on poetry, 4 Shields of Power, Extending the Shade, and Blue Lioness. She was a consultant for a nationally televised series, The Power of Myth, and a host of a radio series, The Next 200 Years. She had a 10-part television series called Conversations with Betty Sue Flowers that was aired on an Austin PBS affiliate, KLRU. She's been a consultant for NASA, a member of the Envisioning Network for General Motors. I could go on and on. This woman is also a visiting advisor to the Secretary of the Navy. Ladies and gentlemen, the return of the marvelous and wonderful Betty Sue Flowers. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Well, thank you, Kim, and thanks for that marvelous introduction. I think my mother may have even believed it.
You have impacted so many people, and when I met you many years ago, I was in touch with something about you that I've long tried to explain, which was that you're a rainmaker, but very few people would probably refer to you as the titles and things that you've done, like even in this introduction, in order to pave the way and open the space for people to receive you. We introduce that, but that doesn't really touch the human being that you are and the kind of contribution you make and the way in which you touch and move people's lives. So really, my interest in this dialogue today is to talk about magic, creativity, the heart, and the spirit, and how come you're so good at working with that in people from every domain in the world, from the highest levels of power to students coming in trying to find out who they are. What is it about you that's at work that you open a space and turn people on to who they are and what they're about? What is it?
Well, Kim, the space is already there. You just have to walk into it. It doesn't really have to do with me. I don't create it. It's there all the time. So really the issue is, if you know that the space is there, what prevents us from being aware of it? So if you've thought about it, really I guess I'm in the job of barrier removal.
It's a lot more than that. You get people in very high places to get in touch with the childlike spirit in them and the magician in them. You, to me, are a kind of midwife, almost. You midwife the magician, the magic in others that's indwelling in them. Does that make sense to you?
It does, although I wouldn't lay claim to that. I just think that that kind of, well, you call it magic, and that's as good a term as any, that kind of magic is lying all around us. And we tend to think that the world is not created for anything but discipline, pain, suffering, struggle. And there's plenty of that in life, but there's also this other side to it where it's dancing with us. And when you can get in touch with that, life becomes a rather marvelous journey.
You've done a lot of things in your life, from raising children, being in marriage for a long time, traveling the world. You've led a very unusual life where you have been dancing in many arenas. How have you been able to do it, seriously?
Well, again, back to the theme of barrier removal, you know, a lot of things are easier if you're not involved in the stress of them. So if you're stress-free, a lot that frees up a huge amount of energy. So what allows someone to do more than it might be thought would be normal is this no stress.
How is it that you create it to be stress-free? How have you done it?
Well, one of the things that causes stress is the story we tell about the future. if you think about it, stress is worry about what may or may not happen. And if you're living fully in the present, you can't be telling a story about the future all the time. And hence, a lot of stress is removed. There's usually a lot of good stuff happening in the present if you can only be awake to see it. And the bad stuff, a lot of it is in the past and the future. After all, the present's really quite small. It's just now.
It's the gateway to everything, isn't it?
That's right. So it's if you think of the difference between immortality and eternity, immortality is lasting a long time. Eternity is no time at all. And
So
the present is a time of no time. And if you're not dwelling on the past or the future, you can really appreciate the things that are going on in the present. And there's usually a lot of beauty and love available in the present, which isn't available when we're stressing out, worrying about, making up stories about the future.
Somewhere in the writings about you, and I noticed there's a lot of writings about you on Google and from all over the place, but you don't have your own website, which I also find a mystery. It's like, well, she's there, but she's not. She's there, but she's not.
Maybe I'll do one of these days, but at the moment, there's no reason to, actually. I mean, I'm not trying to sell anything, so there's really no reason to have a website. I'm on Facebook, but there's not much of me on Facebook. I just say yes to people asking to be my friend if I know them. So that's about it.
Do you think they know what they're getting into?
Oh, well, yeah, because, you know, you go back to you. Your experience came about because of what was already inside you to ask for. So it has nothing to do with me, really. It has to do with the person who's asking.
Well, thank you very much. You're very humble. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. There's an article on Webspace at utexas.edu called Madman, Architect, Carpenter, Judge, Roles, and the Writing Process by Betty Sue Flowers. And I read that, and I thought, what a great way to help people with writing. I'm also a writer. There are so many people that write and love writing and have something to say. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that.
Well, I came up with this idea because when I would talk with students, they were getting all balled up in the writing process, really because they mixed up the roles. They'd have the judge. They'd be judging it before they'd even gotten anything down on paper. And if you have a judge looking over your shoulder, you can't really be creative. It's the way children play when grown-ups aren't around. So when you first start writing, you have to play as if grown-ups aren't around. I call that the madman phase. And then once you've produced a bunch of stuff, you can look at it, see what's there, and usually there's more in us than we usually think of at the moment. But you look at what you've produced, and you begin to sort it out and make it into something. That's the architect phase, see what's there, maybe even outline it. Carpenter phase, you put the sentences together, and then the judge, the fourth phase, you look to see what you've done and judge it, clean it up. And so the reason I divided the writing process into these four roles was to make it easier and, back to our earlier theme, less stressful.
Did you find as a teacher that that was helping students right away start to be able to just download and flow?
Yes, it helped those who actually trusted it enough to try it. It's very difficult for many students to get the judge out of their heads. So for some, it was such a difficult process that they would give up on it. But I would come back to them and say, you know, this has something to do with the rest of your life, not just writing.
That's very wise. There's another piece of writing where you said, I'm paraphrasing, something having to do with the dragon that's in the way of your success.
Yes, I did a little series of pieces on the dragons guarding different gates. And the dragon that guards the gate of success is really fear.
Talk about that.
Part of what hinders us is a fear of failure. But if you're following your own path, there's no such thing as either success or failure. Because your success and failure are comparative terms. And if you're following your own path, who are you comparing yourself to? Nobody. So you can't succeed, you can't fail, you just live an amazing life.
We have such a preoccupation with being successful and what that means and the criteria, which is so deadening and narrowed for what success really is. Think of the people that have had 70, 80 years of working on something. They finally get known for it, and all of a sudden they're validated. And they suffered for 70 or 80 years telling them things about themselves, listening to the people that told them things about themselves before they got their, quote, credibility. It's craziness.
Well, that's true. But then a lot of people who persist in spite of being ignored or laughed at did so because they believed in what they were doing, and that has its own reward. So even those people who never in the end get recognized, whom we never hear of, sometimes they're especially artists. Sometimes they have loved being in their art so much that, truth to tell, they've had happier lives than people who are so-called successes.
That's interesting. We should talk about the fact that you have left Austin and doing work in Austin, even though you've traveled nationally and internationally. And I was wondering if you could share some of the changes and the insights in terms of your life today.
Well, if you've been, at least in worldly terms, certainly what people consider successful, it's a very interesting prospect and causes consternation for those around you to give up the success you have been to strike out on another whole journey. And so that's what I did this past summer. And it's been like a completely new life. It's like starting over again as a teenager. So it's very enlivening. And mostly now I'm writing and thinking and doing a lot with the theater. And that's quite different from running a presidential library.
Talk about what you're doing with the theater a little bit, whatever you feel comfortable to share with us.
Well, it's preliminary stuff so far, but I've fallen in with some theater folks and written a one-act play, which is being performed in April, I think, in a little tiny theater. The wonderful thing about New York is there's so many venues, little tiny places where people try out all sorts of things. So, in fact, this at the moment when you call me, I was reading another play, which was written by someone else to see if that can be turned into something that can be produced. And it's just been a lot of fun. I started off life writing plays when I was a teenager. So it's I'm gathering up threads that were dropped earlier on and seeing what could come out of being alone a lot and writing. And that's very different from the quite public life I've been leading.
Are you still traveling much?
Yes. I've been around the world since July.
No doubt.
Singapore, London several times, and, you know, they're just various Greece. I read a paper in Greece on Athena. So, yes, there are opportunities that keep rising, and life is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Question about scenario building. Could you speak a little bit about the scenario building that you've been doing and working on for many, many years, and also some of the scenario building and the myth surrounding finance that you're involved with, and whatever happened to the healthcare work that you were concerned about, or healthcare reform, and if there's anything you'd like to say about that, it happens to be a pivotal time.
Well, that's a lot. That's a lot, Kim.
Yeah.
let's start with scenarios.
Yes.
Scenarios are fictions about the future, which allow you to think about it in a way that doesn't make you have to adopt one thing or another as a forecast about what the future will be. Because one thing we do know about the future is that we can't predict it. So how do you deal with the future without being stuck in a story? You have several stories. So a lot of what I do with corporations and groups like the Center for Disease Control or the World Business Council for Sustainable Development is to come up with alternate stories about the future. I just finished writing one for the post-global financial crisis world with a group from the James Martin Institute at Oxford University in England. And basically, there were two stories about the future. One I called growth, and the other health. And the growth story, this is in cartoon form, you understand, because there are a lot of charts and graphs and things like that. But the growth story is basically we continue along the way we're doing with a few minor adjustments and hope for the best. And the health story is a different world of finance in which we incorporate values such as global environmental values, carbon structures, that kind of thing, into our financial system. And that's a new way of thinking. So when people talk about these stories, they go over each of the stories in turn and contemplate what life would be like under each of those domains. So that's basically what I've been doing lately, one of the things I've done since coming to New York, and it's been a lot of fun.
How do you not get trapped in the politics of the times?
Well, we're all, to some extent, trapped in our own times, and certainly I pay attention to it. But again, if you're used to dealing in stories, you recognize how much of politics, how much of what we hear as politics, how much of that is really a story. And you know we can tell better stories about who we are and what's possible. So listening to these stories, I think of different and better stories, and sometimes meet people I can tell these stories to, and sometimes they're policymakers, sometimes not. But all of us have our hand in creating the global story, and that's really the important story going on these days.
In terms of the U.S. at this point in the conversation, do you have any concerns about our liberty and our constitutional framework and what the founders intended for us versus, for example, what's unfolding in the change of laws and executive orders, et cetera, et cetera? And I really ask that as a generic question, because it really wouldn't matter what president was in or what side of the political realm.
Well, anyone who's run an institution, as I have, knows how really fragile they are, even if they look strong from the outside. I think that our founders knew the Constitution would always be a living document and somewhat vulnerable. So I don't think there's ever been a time in the history of our country where the Constitution wasn't vulnerable from one thing or another. And it's in a remarkable document, but it's reinterpreted for every generation. And given the new media, we hardly even know how to deal with the future. That is, our liberties have in the past been upheld in part by news media and others telling us what's going on. Well, now there's such a blooming, buzzing confusion of people telling us what's going on, and such a sea change in the business model for media, that it's hard for people in one country to agree on a story of what reality is, much less a story of where they would like to take their country. So I think the multiplicity of stories is both an opportunity and a problem these days, and that the Constitution is, as always, both vulnerable and strong. We're in a real period of change when it comes to how we are together as a people.
That was a beautiful answer. I had an opportunity to do a segment on health freedom, the ability to choose our own supplements, our own herbs, to get medicines as we need them. And in that segment, I had the opportunity to understand further that even if you have health care opportunity at this time, there's no architecture of conversation or thought or foundational platform yet for individuals to be able to get supplements, herbs, other remedies, and ways that people have been healed and prevented from being ill. So it's not even on the table yet. With that going on, and what appears to be more and more legal statutes and instruments narrowing people's choices, if in fact healthcare goes through, however it goes through, okay, and people are forced to buy it, and they have no say over the cost of it, and it's not necessarily the kind of health policies that people want to buy, and if they can't afford it, they either end up being taken to jail or they're fined hundreds and thousands of dollars. How do you see altering the conversation of something that restrictive and tyrannical? To me, it's tyrannical to force that. But I'm wondering how somebody like you, who deals in scenario building, would open that up to bring that on the table of healthcare and wellness.
Well, I think it would be more palpable to people if you did have scenarios. One of the disciplines of scenario making is that you don't just say, here's what the world looks like. You say, how did we get there?
Mm-hmm.
And you could have the future of the world without it and the future of the world with it, not as assertions, but as actual stories. And there's so much misinformation and so much, you know, every scenario of that type that we've been hearing has a lot of assumptions in it, a lot of ifs. So we'd sort of need to have scenarios which, when you tell stories in scenario form, they're quite detailed. So you can't just make a bland statement. It's you look at the story and you say, oh, that's how much it cost. Oh, but the healthcare proposal is costing X instead of Y. So until you start really getting into the nitty-gritty, you can't build a scenario that has any palpable reality to it. Now, I should say my experience is different from a lot of Americans because I actually lived in a country, England, that had so-called socialist medicine, and my experience with it was very, very good. Case in point, my husband, while playing squash in England, while we were both very poor. I was a graduate student, not allowed to work there. That's the English way. You don't work as a graduate student. And so my husband was supporting me by teaching kindergarten. So we were recycling our paper napkins, you know, a
wow.
week with the same paper napkin type thing. We were very poor. He was playing squash with a friend and tore his knee up, which required immediate operation. He was taken to a hospital. He was operated on. He stayed in the hospital 2 weeks and had extensive rehab every day. Medication, the whole thing, and the whole cost to us, which would have, we would have gone bankrupt in the United States, the whole cost to us was a big fat zero. And this was in 1970.
Right.
That's 40 years ago, and it's not given him one bit of trouble since. Excellent care. So, and I could give other examples of this. But, it was a really wonderful thing, and we were guests in the country. We weren't even paying taxes. It was just very humane.
And I'm for that. And yet it seems as if, not to interrupt you, but it seems as if the kind of conversations and the kind of publicity that is surrounding what's occurring or what appears to be occurring that's on the table, it's almost antithetical to getting anything that would really work done.
Well, you know how you can tell whether it's helpful conversation or not. You can ask, what is the fear level evoked by the stories? And if the fear level is very high, you know that something else is going on besides trying to figure out the best way to go forward together. And both sides have raised fear level quite high, I think.
Yeah, not really having a one-sided conversation, because actually, for me, it doesn't matter what the side is. I go with the person and what it is that they're trying to accomplish and what is the detail and the scenario that's on the table. I had a colleague that was a physicist, a brilliant physicist that was under 40 that died a few months ago. And it was so sad. He didn't have health insurance and he couldn't get Medicare to pay for this operation that he needed.
Uh-huh.
And he died and he was under 40 and has a family of several kids and his wife, et cetera. And I thought to myself, how many people can't get support like that because they're not in a financial position to do it? So there's a whole humane side of me that says, whatever it is, help people. The part that scares me is when we're starting to be told how many vaccines we need to get. In other words, we're only allowed to take certain medications. The FDA starts to take away our supplements. Bills start coming up to the House and the Senate to remove our rights to have a say about those supplements. When there is what appears to be an FDA tyrannical takeover of the entire planet, and when there's this concerted global effort to alter our ability to choose, there are things that are occurring so fast. So to me, the art of this whole thing really is how you hold being in this transition, how you navigate the stories we tell ourselves about this transition, and how to stay out of fear. And my question to you is, with a lot of keys and things going on very fast and new laws taking place and wanting to control the net and wanting to control this, so there's a huge control factor at work. And a lot of people are afraid of it, legitimately afraid of it. So how do those of us that are concerned stay in the poise-centered mode where we become part of a generative conversation and stay out of the polarization? How do we do it?
Well, it's almost the other way around. That is, you have to stay out of the polarization in order even to see what's going on. For example, a lot of what's going on with what you're alluding to with the FDA and the laws that are passed that don't allow you to have certain natural supplements and that kind of thing, That happens not because of the health care bill or anything to do with health. It has to do with our campaign financing, which in this company is in this country is done by corporations. So if a major pharmaceutical company has given you several million dollars to run and win your campaign, you carry their bill, which may be get rid of natural supplements, which in some way are against your pharmaceutical. So if you see what I'm saying,
yeah,
if we had campaign finance reform, a lot of the things that go on now would not go on. Here's a case in point. I don't know if my former hometown Austin had a terrible incident recently with a man flying an airplane into the IRS building to make a point. He was a self-employed computer worker. And his point was that there was part of the law, the 1986 tax reform law, did not allow him to work independently. He had to be a contractor for a company. It's a law that singles out him. Well, that law, it so happens, was passed to benefit one corporation. It was put in as a little rider. It's not that our representatives particularly care about singling out one group of people to say, no, you can't work for yourself. It was a little, a little piece of honey thrown to a campaign underwriter. So things like that, our laws are pockmarked with those special little deals for companies that have paid money to help someone get elected. And if we had campaign finance reform, we could go through that thicket and clear out all those little special laws, and I think that would help our democracy a great deal.
How can we do it? How can this get done? Do you see campaign finance reform as being able to be potentiated in my lifetime?
Well, I wished very much that Barack Obama had done this as the first thing, because had he done this, health care would have been up or down and cleared out of the thicket of all the special interest stuff that's been stuck in there. Because then representatives could have voted on their conscience and what their constituencies wanted, and not based on who's contributed to their campaign. So now, at the moment, I think it'd be very difficult to do, because every new president has a honeymoon period for about 6 months. When I ran the LBJ Library, it was incredible to see what Lyndon Johnson did in the first 6 months. He knew this. He knew he had only that much time to get things done. And within a year, he was passing major civil rights bills that people thought could never happen, and Medicare and NEH and public broadcasting and a lot of the things that we have with us now. And poverty fell more in the first year, in the 4 years that he was president, actually four and a half, than any time before or since. So things can be done, but you have to see clearly what it is that needs to be done. And in this case, it's not so much about health care as it is about campaign finance.
It's kind of the central nervous system of what's making it possible for these things to happen that really shouldn't be happening.
I don't see that our representatives have anything against natural supplements. They just owe a lot to the pharmaceutical companies that support them so heavily.
How do you see campaign finance being done, and do you think it can be done in the next 5 years?
I think it can only be done during a honeymoon period, when a president can do no wrong, and when he has such a huge amount of public support that representatives have to override their own special interests in order to vote in the public interest. But that's a very small amount of time under any president, and Obama's already passed that time. There's already great dissension, and there's some question even if the health care bill can be passed. So it's a little late for this president.
If you could go in today to the White House and advise Obama or try to help in this matter related to health care, is it inappropriate to ask what you would try to do with him or what you would try to say?
Well, we're in sort of the end game of voting, so if you said go today, I don't think there's anything. It just has to play it out. But had I had that opportunity a year ago when he first came to office, I would have said, as others have said, campaign finance reform, pass that immediately. And then the second thing I would have said is come out with exactly what you think ought to be done with health care. be very clear. And then if you want to be bipartisan, let both sides offer positive solutions and be there as the mediator between the very much in the open between the two sets of positive solutions, not just people saying what they're against, but what they're for.
I think that's fabulous. And now at this end game of voting, I read the other day that Nancy Pelosi was just going to pass this thing and try to push it through. And I know it's a very sensitive thing. And Nancy Pelosi could be anybody with a different name. The Speaker of the House who comes in and says, just push it through. Do you think that that's okay?
Well, it's not okay, but it's the way things have worked for the past 8 years.
Right.
So they are saying, okay, I guess it's impossible to be post-partisan. So we'll just have to go back to politics as usual. The way certain things were passed under Republicans, we'll do the same thing as Democrats. And it's unfortunate.
Okay. I appreciate your candor with this because I have been losing my peace over watching what I consider to be a loss of a democratic process or the proper process being able to have its way to get this thing done properly. And I've been very sad about it.
Well, yes, it's, you know, what they say about you shouldn't see laws or sausage being made. And
I didn't know that.
Yes, that's a very old saying. I think maybe Mark Twain, I'm not sure. But it's not a very pretty sight. And in a way, when we think of integrity, we think of people not bowing to pressure one side or another. But politics is all about horse trading.
What does horse trading mean? Because I don't know about that.
Well, it's about saying, okay, I'll give you two dams in Montana if you'll give me three Air Force bases in Texas. It's about that kind of thing. Typically, it has been. And those deals were done behind closed doors. And now that everything is out in the open, those deals look really, they don't look good at all. So it's about horse trading. It's about, I'll give you what you want. If you give me what I want, you vote for this, I'll vote for that. But our public narrative is really about black hats and white hats. And so it's very difficult for politicians these days to do the kind of trading that typically allowed them to get things done. But now doesn't look good at all.
Do you think that you and I will ever be alive to see politics transformed so that most of the narrative going on in the paper, on the internet, and in television and radio is no longer about the Republicans and the Democrats? Frankly, I'm sick of hearing about it. I don't know why it takes up so much energy and so much time is given to the bifurcation of these parties. Who cares? If they all do the same deals and they act in similar ways with different faces and different names, what difference does it make?
Well, human nature is such that we pay more attention to fights than we do to harmonious conversation. And after all, the media outlets are businesses. So if you want someone to pay attention to you, you stage a fight or you tell a story in terms of a fight. Without conflict, there's no story. And so a story in the traditional sense. So no matter what's going on in terms of making legislation, the story is always going to be about who won and who lost because we listen to that. We tune in. It has a higher energy than come, let us reason together. So we will stay on the channel which has people shouting at each other as opposed to the channel which shows, C-SPAN would be the example, you know. So if it's low energy, then not too many people watch it.
And lastly, what's going to happen this year in New York with you? Are there some things, are there some plays that we are going to be able to see that you're staging? Or
I kind of doubt it. I doubt it this year. I don't know. I'm very interested in new media. I'm very interested in what can be done with blogs and with publishing on sites such as Lulu, which allows people to publish their own books. And then
I love that.
Yeah, it's a new world of the democratization of art in that sense, and for good and for ill. And I'm very interested in that. So I've had regular publishers, you know, in the past, and have gone through the traditional routes for books and everything else. And they would publish me again, I think. But I'm really interested in, okay, what might happen with new media? What happens if you do a blog on a particular subject and then publish a book on Lulu comprised of pieces of that blog? And what would happen if different voices were encouraged out there that aren't the ones like me who've been in the mix before, but brand new voices? I don't know. It's a very exciting time.
It is an exciting time. You know, I went through a period for 5 years. Nobody would accept my show in America. And I had tried going to the satellite, and I had tried going to public broadcasting, and I went to commercial broadcasting. And for 5 years, nobody was interested. So I had stopped broadcasting, and I noticed I was very sad in my life because there was a part of my life that I really love and am passionate about that I wasn't doing. And so I was inspired by my girlfriend to go back and just start the thing in December, on December 7th. And I had done a workshop, and somebody attending my workshop said, let me take care of this for you. He's a sound engineer and he's a webmaster. And I had been doing all the groundwork, figuring out what kind of software I wanted to use. And we got started, and I designed the site, and he helped put it together, and it's a broadcast blog. And we're now almost at 10,000 people a month. I've done no marketing on this show, nothing.
But see, that's wonderful, Kim, and I think that gives me great hope for democracy, no matter what's happening in Washington. The fact that we can talk to each other without the mediators there, we can talk directly to each other, I think is a wonderful opportunity.
The other thing I want to share with you about doing blogs, just before we end this conversation, is that one of the delights of doing this on the net, when I first started doing it on the net in 2004, blogs weren't around. And if they were, they were minuscule.
Yeah.
That hadn't taken off yet. So when I went from a small network radio show in Colorado to the internet, it was nothing. Doing it live was very expensive, and it still wasn't worth it. But when I took it to the net, it was like a dead duck. So my perception of the internet was, if I go on the internet, it's a dead duck. It won't do anything. And when I started to do this show on the net and allow people to respond and give comments and share if they liked the show or they didn't like the show, to share that too, I was so excited. And something happened. I did a show on climate and weather, my first number one show on climate and weather. Because I am so committed to learning and due diligence, I love to learn, even if what I learn is difficult. And I don't accept a lot of the official stories about many things. That's one of my gifts, but it can make life a little more complex. But I did this show on climate and weather, and I had several people on. And a month and a half later, I invited a guest that was in a completely, and I mean completely, different field of study. And he said to me, you know, my colleague went to your site, and apparently you're a climate denier. And I said, what? And he goes, you're a climate denier, and I need to distance myself from you, so I can't really do this interview. And I thought about it, and anyway, we ended up talking, and I ended up giving the guy like a little consult about how he has to unlock from what other people project onto him, that this is about supporting something that he's doing that's making a contribution, and it's not about if everybody likes every show, and that there's plenty of room for everybody. Plus, I'm not a climate denier, but the fact is that months later, his colleague, who was also invited on the show, said he didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I said to him, you know, the reason I do this on the net and I've taken this on is because not only do I get to invite anybody I want to my show, but I get to invite people from all different backgrounds and perspectives. And if people are not polite to me and they are not operating in a professional manner, I don't have to have them on the show. I have no pressure from groups, financiers, or anybody.
Right.
This is incredible about getting people's blessings, their benefits, their contributions out, even if they haven't been heard before. And so all of a sudden, something that somebody may have spent a life on that nobody ever heard of, that's so important, that could be utilized today, right? Even in the financial turmoil that a lot of the world is in. There are people I interview that are like 80 years old, 75 years old, 90 years old, who have such important things for people to hear today of all ages, all backgrounds, etc. The traditional media would never give them a chance. Not only the platform, the proper context, the introduction, establishing a receptive way in which people can hear them. That's why the net is so important. And why people should just go for it if they want to do it. And I'm sorry I waited 5 years. I'm sorry I let the traditional media experience lower my vibration and dampen my spirit where I wasn't broadcasting. How sad. But I'm glad I'm back.
Good, Kim. That's good. That was a very eloquent defense of the new media, too. So I go for it. I'm glad you have.
And the other thing is, what I'm realizing in the math arena is that you can have, for 21 days, a network of people making commitments to invite people to listen. And you can have millions of people, if you go ahead with a program, listening to some type of offering that you have, mm-hmm. some type of contribution that you have. It is now easier to get things done and get things heard than ever before. The thing is, you don't always know what people are going to do with things that you put out there. That's the risk you take putting stuff out there. But it's a worthy risk.
Yeah, I think so too.
Sorry, I went on a little bit long there, but I wanted really to make the point that there's all kinds of people that come in to try to project how things should be done and how people should do things and all that kind of stuff. And that's why people should go do their own thing, because the net is the place where you have an opportunity to make your unique contributions, your style, your input, and others available to people. So Betty Sue, I'd like to ask you if there's anything you'd like to say in wrapping up our show today. I know we've gone over 30 minutes, but God help us all.
No, thank you, Kim. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you all the luck in the world on this this endeavor that you're doing, and may the sun shine on you and the rain when you need it.
Yes, thank you so much. You know, rainmaking is about the sunshine.
Yes, and it's also about the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with, learning from, engaging Dr. Betty Sue Flowers, the author of Extending the Shade, Fathers and Daughters, Browning and the Modern Tradition, and many more books. Betty Sue, thank you so much, and I hope you come back and visit us on It's Rainmaking Time. God bless
you.
Thank
you, Kim. You too.